Hi, this is Paul. I haven't even finished on the Peugeot-Doug Murray-Peterson conversation. I've got another chunk of it, the second third of it done, and it's ready to go, and I decided not to release it this Monday morning. I'm traveling tomorrow to Southern California for some church work, but then drops Peterson's talk with Peter Kreeft, and I've been a fan of Peter Kreeft's work for a very long time. I grew up watching my father both read Kreeft's books and also telling stories about Kreeft. Just from the intro, Kreeft is a couple of years younger than my father, although my father passed away in 2013. My father would often preach, do pulpit supply in the RCA church that Kreeft grew up in. And if you go to Eastern Christians Wikipedia page, you have to go to the Eastern Christian School Association Wikipedia page, otherwise you get Eastern Christianity, and you go to notable alumni, you get the Jonas Brothers first. And now all of these pop stars came long after I got out of Eastern Christian. There were no pop stars when I went to Eastern Christian. But Peter Kreeft, born 1937, is the only philosopher named there. And as noted, he went to Eastern Christian. His parents obviously were not prototypical. They would have they went to the Reformed Church of America. Sort of the split between the Reformed Church of America and the Christian Reformed Church was that Christian Reformed kids went to Christian school, Reformed Church of America went to public school. But Kreeft went to Christian school and then went to Calvin College. And in the Daily Wire portion, he tells the story about how he became Roman Catholic, actually fairly early on. It was a lot of story I hadn't noticed. Now, there is a Daily Wire portion after this one. I wasn't too annoyed, except I always find the Daily Wire app annoying. The Daily Wire app does not give, it's not as easy to find things in there, and there's not a, I don't know, I just get annoyed by the Daily Wire app. But the portion in the Daily Wire app was really good. In a sense, Peterson starts out this video in this mode that he's kind of been in a lot of the different conversations. Here's what I've been thinking. Tell me what you think. Which isn't a particularly good way to start a conversation, but about a half hour, 45 minutes, hour into this, he sort of relaxes, and then the conversation starts to flow. And by the time they get to the last half hour, which is just behind the Daily Wire paywall, they're both very comfortable, and they're both talking well, and it's just delightful. And Kreeft starts talking about Lewis. Of course, if you look at Kreeft's work, there's a body of MP3s out on the internet from Peter Kreeft. I found those years ago, and I listened to all of them. I listened to some of them multiple times. He's a fun guy to listen to, and the key thing. I wrote this on Twitter actually. Kreeft has a real ability. He says in the interview that he's not so much an original philosopher. What Kreeft has an ability to do is make things very clear and concise. One of the Kreeft books that I first bought, apart from books that I got from my father, one of the Kreeft books that I first bought was an outline of apologetics. And it's I think I have both the Logos version and the physical version. Let me see if I can get the physical version here a second. Yeah, I might have it in storage or something. I couldn't grab onto the physical copy of this. Used to be a blue book. Now it's got pretty pictures on it. I just looked it up on Amazon. Handbook of Christian Apologetics, Hundreds of Answers to Crucial Questions. And what I really liked about it, I found it really helpful in terms of sermon prep because it was just sort of arranged in a very logical fashion, and the answers are just concise. It's almost an outline. It's just like bang, 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 bang. And that's really Kreeft's gift. And so when Peterson starts in this conversation on sort of his, again, the mode that he's been in lately, this is what I'm thinking. Let me know what you think of it. Kreeft just has bullet point tight answers that are well-seasoned. He's, like I said, he was born 2 years after my father. He's still alive. His wife is still alive. He's in his 80s. He's still teaching. Grew up in New Jersey. It's got to be a great guy. He's got to be a great guy. And I'm not going to do a commentary on the whole thing, partly because sometimes when I hear a conversation this good, I just don't want to touch it because there's just so much good stuff in it. And I know a number of you people at both the events in Europe and in Canada told me, yeah, I don't even watch Jordan's stuff. And, you know, I only watch you commenting on it. Watch this conversation with Peter Kreeft. You will not be disappointed. And I did spring for the Daily Wire Plus app, et cetera, so I can get all of that. Now, I'm not going to spring that stuff behind the paywall. I understand how paywalls work. I'm going to honor the paywall. The stuff behind the paywall I thought was very, very interesting, too, partly because C.S. Lewis came up. Now, I just looked at what I've got on my shelf from C.S. Lewis, and I found this copy of, seems to be, I don't see it's, that they didn't have a date of this printing, 95 cents, probably one of the early copies of Miracles in paperback. This is the one, almost spilled my drink. Good thing I had the lid on it. This is the one that it'll look like more often, but they got into C.S. Lewis, and Kreeft regularly has conversations and content about Lewis and Tolkien. He's a huge Lewis fan. He's a huge Tolkien fan. They get into that in the Behind the Paywall Daily Wire Plus section. Now, there is a section here that I wanted to play because I actually thought it was important. And it both has sort of the clipped part up front, the teaser, but then it goes further. And I think I am, in a lot of ways, what Kreeft was able to do with Peterson in this conversation is something I have wanted to see someone do. And I think Kreeft handled it absolutely perfectly. So I did want to play some of this. So let's at least play some of it. I don't know how much I'll interrupt. Then again, this is what I do.
And he's classed with the Christian existentialists as a consequence of the practicalities of his view. He basically puts forward a proposition that I think is akin to the proposition that undergirds marriage, which is you cannot find out, and this is relevant to Pascal's wager, you cannot find out whether creation as such is good or evil without being all in on your bet. Just like you can't be married without saying, well, I'm...
Now, this is, of course, I'm going to comment on it. This is really good because what he's doing is he's taking on the problem of evil. And in a sense, what he's saying is you can't just sit back from the problem of evil and postulate as if you're on a throne, seated above, you know, looking down upon your monarchical vision of the world, imagining that you have a position or have an ability to see everything. You can only engage in the problem of evil if you enter into the world, which says something deeply about the incarnation. If you enter into the world and place your bets and say, you know, I will not sit outside the world. I will not just declare nihilistically that life isn't worth living and it's better not to exist than to exist. I am going in. I am laying my money down. I am putting all of my chips on the table. I am all in.
Shackling myself to you, and I'm not going to run away no matter what. So we better get to know each other and get along because this is how it's going to be. And without that, you can't be deeply committed enough to the marriage to make it work. So it seems to me on the forefront of faith, which is you have to act in the world with courageous trust, not naive trust, but courageous trust in the potential goodness of being in order to actually discover.
Now, here's a critique of Peterson that you're going to get from me regularly. He's made it all impersonal, being just as such. Keep it sort of theoretical, abstract. And the thing is, when you go all in, it's no longer theoretical or abstract. It's personal. It's completely there. But Peterson keeps wanting to hedge his bets on the impersonal nature of reality and hold back. And Kreeft, very subtly and politely and gently, isn't going to let that stand.
Potential trust, not naive trust, but courageous trust in the potential goodness of being, in order to actually discover whether or not that faith is justified. And so and that's partly why it's faith, is that you have to put the cart before the horse. You can't wait around. You know, in the book of Revelation, when Christ comes back to judge everyone, he says something like, if you were neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. And so his harshest judgment isn't reserved for outright, unrepentant, committed sinners, and certainly not for people who are 100% committed to the courage of their faith. But the judgment is harshest for people who play both ends against the middle and who won't commit. And one of the things...
Jordan, you got to feel that, my friend. I mean, because if we've had a fence sitter, it's you.
Things that I've started to toy with is the idea that faith is actually a subset in some sense of existential courage. You know, I've talked to my listeners and viewers about the notion that if you want to pursue the good, you do that in some sense despite. So if you're naive, you're good because you think everything is good and everyone is good. But if you're naive, you're immature and you're unwise. And then you get jolted out of that naivety by betrayal and tragedy. And then you become, or you're tempted by cynicism. And the cynicism is wiser than the ignorant naivety. But it's not good. It's the desert, let's say. It's the Exodus desert after the tyranny of naivety. The way out of that is to evince a courageous faith. And the courageous faith is something like, I'm going to do good despite the evidence for tragedy and malevolence and the atrocity of history and all of that. And that's part of the courage of faith. I'm going to commit myself to this. And that, in some sense, bypasses Pascal's wager, because it doesn't even have anything to do, in some sense, with, what would you say, your own redemption. It's a decision about how to be in the face of the catastrophe of life. And you have
a decision of how to be in the face of the catastrophe. Again, it sounds so abstract, impersonal, distant.
You have to make a decision one way or another, because you're either going to take the Mephistophelian route and say, you know, life is so terrible that it should just come to an end, and that if there is a God, he should be damned for having the presumption to make such a terrible world. Or you're going to say, no, despite everything, I'm going to work in all possible ways to make everything better and to tell the truth while moving forward. And I'm going to
make everything better, tell the truth while moving. I mean, again, all good things, but it's not a personal engagement. It's not Jacob wrestling with God at the J-Book. It's not Jesus on the Mount of Temptation. It's not Jesus on the cross. It's still a little distant.
I'm going to conduct my life according to those principles, and then I'm going to have the adventure that comes along with that and see what happens.
So very noble, rather stoic.
That's what the scientific atheist does not understand, I think, that there are some truths that you cannot simply discover. You have to live them. You have to make the experiment. I think of Kierkegaard's Night of Faith from the viewpoint of Juliet. Here comes Romeo with no guarantees. He does not bring an array of lawyers and philosophers to persuade her that it is utterly rational for her to elope with him. He says, leap into my arms. And she does not know whether that will end well or not. It's an act of faith. It's a leap. And in the play, of course, it doesn't pay off. They both die. Or you might say that even that, since it was, in a sense, a noble death, was a payoff. But there's no guarantee. That's why there's faith.
Yeah, well, there's this idea.
See how fast Kreef did that? See how fast Kreef did that? Bang!
Idea from the materialist determinists, let's say, that if we just derived enough information about the nature of things that we could produce an algorithm that would enable us how to compute our movement forward.
Right. If we could, we're going to sit back from it. We're going to think about it. We're going to decide. We're going to define. We're going to have our arguments. We're going to give it all out here.
Now, that is naive.
The problem with that, it is naive. Well, I think it's technically naive because I've talked to some great scientists like Sir Roger Penrose, and Penrose believes that in principle, the horizon of the future is not fundamentally predictable from the positions of the past. This is not a clockwork universe, that the horizon of that what we confront is a horizon of potential, which I think of as somewhat equivalent to the chaos that God confronted at the beginning of time, that we confront this potential that has multiple potential branches, which is the way that the world could array itself as a consequence of our decision, and that we impose a vision on that. And that vision is a production of faith. And then we enact the vision, and that enacting is an act of faith. And that's part of what's attracted me to the existential thinkers, let's say, rather than the scientific materialist determinists.
I would not use the word impose. I would use the word add. Whether the universe is a clockwork universe or not doesn't much matter, because our lives are not clockwork lives, so that we can add to the universe new data by our choices, by our living. And what effect that has on the universe, I don't know. I don't know if the stars tremble a little bit when we love each other more or not. I suspect that there's some connection, because spiritual gravity and physical gravity have to be at least analogous. And if every particle of matter in the universe is relative to every other particle of matter in the universe, why shouldn't every particle of personality, every individual human being, and their choices and their loves and hates also have effects on everyone? That's the Russian concept.
There's meaning. There's deep meaning in what he just said.
...of subornost, which is so strong in Dostoevsky, especially the brothers Karamazov. I love Ivan Karamazov. He's my favorite atheist. He's passionate. He's committed. He's moral. He's a moral atheist. He's not an amoral atheist.
Yeah. Right. Well, and he's admirable, and he's charismatic, and he's good looking. And I mean, one of the things that's so absolutely wonderful about Dostoevsky, which puts him in the top rank of all-time geniuses, I actually prefer Dostoevsky to Nietzsche in the final analysis, I would say, although it's a tight battle, is that when Dostoevsky makes an atheist, he pulls out all the plugs, man. And so I know in The Brothers Karamazov, Ivan
pulls out all the stops.
Ends pretty much all of his arguments with
it's an organ metaphor.
Alyosha, because he's so articulate and so able to put forward his claims. Although Alyosha beats him on the characterological side, which is one of the great, what would you say, brilliant literary accomplishments of Dostoevsky. It's really something.
I don't think anyone in history has ever written fiction about Jesus, which moves you, except Dostoevsky. And in The Grand Inquisitor, Jesus says nothing and does nothing except for that kiss, and that's sufficient. And it looks as if Ivan won the argument earlier than that, because Ivan got Alyosha to admit, if you were God and you were creating a universe and you gave man free will and you saw that it would inevitably result in these horrors, these parents who are torturing their children, would you consent to be the architect? And
right.
Alyosha, who's utterly honest, says, no, I wouldn't consent. So there is an Ivan in Alyosha. There is a rebel in us, and it's a good rebel. God approves Job's rebellion rather than the three friends' comfort. At the end of the book of Job, God says an amazing thing. He says to the three friends, I burn with anger against you because you have not spoken rightly about me as my servant Job has. But what they said was simply orthodox. It's in the rest of the Bible. God is great and God is good. Let us thank him for our food. Amen. And Job, who admitted that his words were wild because this...
the prayer that every Christian Reformed kid grows up with.
Sufferings are so great, is accusing God and wishing that he could take him to court. And yet God approves that honest rebellion on Job's part rather than the comfortable acceptance on the part of the three friends. Dostoevsky must have loved that.
Right. Well, Job is at least wrestling as honestly as possible with the issues of tragedy and malevolence. He's facing that four square. And I would suspect that the reason, to put words in God's mouth, that Job is approved of is that the more naive advocates for God's goodness are merely avoiding looking at the calamity and catastrophe and protecting themselves in that way. But that means a real faithlessness in some profound sense, because as Nietzsche pointed out, I suppose, is that there's some real utility in staring into an abyss. And Nietzsche warned, right, if you stare into an abyss, the abyss might stare into you, and that if you fight with monsters, you risk becoming a monster. And that's an extremely wise caution. But one of the things I've sort of sorted out in relationship to the crucifixion image is that the crucifixion image and the passion story, in some real sense, and I'm speaking psychologically here, not religiously, at least to begin with, is the ultimate abyss.
At least to begin with.
Because it brings together all the elements of unfair suffering that might characterize life, or that do characterize life. It brings them together in a single story. And then it makes the claim that if you gaze upon that image with sufficient intensity and duration, and perhaps faith, which you have to have in order to gaze upon it at all, is that what you end up seeing and contemplating is not death and hell, but the resurrection and the overcoming of death and hell. And you know, one of the things clinicians have learned in the last 100 years, perhaps above all else, maybe they learned two things, is that honest dialogue promotes health and redeems. And that's the first thing. And the second thing is, if you face what...
Now, you know who you are, who I'm about to talk to, because you keep putting questions in the comments about this whole estuary thing. What if someone's in a church and they speak heresy? What if someone's in a church and they learn heresy? And to that I have to say, people are always speaking and learning heresy in church. It's happening all the time. But now, listen to what Peterson just said. And that's part of why I think estuary is a good thing. Is it a foolproof thing? Well, will someone not go astray because of it? Well, I'll tell you, if my standard for action or inaction was that no one would ever go astray because of what I did, I could do nothing, including preach, including teach, especially make videos. But what Peterson just said here is a really important truth, and I think he's right.
Dying of death and hell. And you know, one of the things clinicians have learned in the last 100 years, perhaps above all else, maybe they learned two things, is that honest dialogue promotes health and redeems.
Honest dialogue promotes health and redeems. What is estuary supposed to do? Promote honest dialogue. And I believe Peterson's right. It's healthy and it redeems. And that's why people need to do it. A lot of the people that I'm thinking about and talking to and talking about aren't ready to sit and listen to a sermon. Once it's a preacher, once it's a sermon, all the walls are up. Nothing's getting through. Honest dialogue. It's healthy. It brings health and it redeems. Peterson's right. And that's what's behind estuary. It's honest dialogue.
And that's the first thing. And the second thing is, if you face what disturbs you and forces you into paralysis and avoidance and tyranny, if you face that forthrightly and voluntarily, that will ennoble your character and help you grow. And so a lot of what a clinician does is take a fear that someone might have that's paralyzing them and then break it down into small subsets, sort of like the brick in relationship to the cathedral, and then have people practice voluntary confrontation. And what inevitably happens is not that people get less afraid, but that they become braver and more competent. And so then you might say, if you tied that back into this idea of the evil that besets creation and the notion of human free will, you might say...
Back to the question of the problem of evil.
...say that the universe is constituted such that it's a greater good that evil can exist as a possibility, and that it's a greater good that human beings have free will than that they're compelled slaves. And the downside of that is that we can freely choose evil. And then that accounts for the pervasive evil that characterizes human endeavor and the cosmos in some sense, but that a world without that possibility, because it would involve pure subjugation and no choice and no voluntary assent and no real destiny, a world without that would be a much lesser place. Because one of the things you can say is that it's possible that God left human beings something important to do.
Yes, and that's very good theology and very good apologetic.
And this is where Kreeft really turns and where he really shines right here.
And even, in a sense, justifying the ways of God to man. But that's not yet religion. That's still, I'm in the driver's seat, and I'm making the road maps, and I'm traveling on this journey, and I'm making my life meaningful, and I'm making my character honest and courageous, and that's all very good. But that's not yet Abrahamic theism, that's Norse mythology. Maybe the gods will go down into defeat. Maybe evil is stronger than good. Well, then let's go down in defeat on the right side, because right is more important than might. And that's noble. That's the second best thing in the world. But then you have the resurrection. Then you have the God who adds power to his goodness and his love. So you have it all together. But that has to come from God, not from us. So our response to that has to be secondary. It has to be a response. We don't impose that upon the universe. We don't read our faith into the universe. We are Juliet, and we see Romeo coming with this marriage proposal, and we say yes to it, like the Blessed Virgin Mary. You know, fiat, be it done unto me according to your will. That's the essence of religion. And that's why I love Islam. It's so simple. It's so centered on absolute surrender and submission.
Okay. So.
But that's exactly where Peterson is at. That it's this finally isn't dragging your heavy cross up the hill or redeeming your father from the underworld. Now, sometimes you do have to drag your cross up the hill, and sometimes you do have to save your father from the underworld. But it's finally our response to what God has done on our behalf. And yeah, so that's there's another moment in the Daily Wire section which is likened to this one, where Peterson is sort of bringing out his brand of you have an Augustinian world and a Pelagian soteriology. That's sort of where Jordan winds up with a lot of his stuff. And Kreeft basically says, no, it's good news is finally good news, not good advice. So yeah, this is one of the great Peterson videos, one of the great Peterson conversations. Don't miss it. If you've got the Daily Wire Plus thing, go ahead and listen to it all the way to the end, because there's a lot of good nuggets about Kreeft, and there's some stuff about C.S. Lewis. So that was good. But if you don't have it, you know, you'll be fine, because the meat of it is in this section. So let me know what you think. Leave a comment.